for inviting me. Try to hold this thing. So this, unfortunately, will, or fortunately, will not be a continuation of any previous talks. So you can all rest, I hope. I'd really like to make this a kind of an easy talk. So there will be various moments at which it would be convenient to fall asleep, and I will wake you up as necessary. However, I'd really like, you know, if you want to do that and do want to wake up later, which you may not want to. To at least, you know, get the first part, and then after that it will be sort of disjointed. So the talk is about applications of free stochastic differential equations to a number of areas in free probability theory and things which are of relevance to the subject of this conference. So I have to admit that until about a year ago, I was very scared of the word stochastic, and by extension of the word stochastic differential equation. And then I was very fortunate that Alice explained to me what these are, and that I somehow have grown to like them a lot. So let me write down what one means here. So this is a subject that was really initiated by Philippe Bihan and Roland Speicher. In late 90s, it's 98 if I'm not mistaken, something like that, right? That they started, well, they worked a lot on this. And so here's a stochastic differential equation, dxt is equal to dst, I'll leave a little gap here, minus 1/2 c of x of t, right, dx of t, dt, okay? So what's going on here? So first of all, what is x of t? So presumably x of t is a solution. What does that mean? Well, it means for one that x of t is a process. X of t, at each time t, you have an n-tuple of variables, x1 of t, xn of t. And so each xj of t is, let's say, self-adjoint for our purposes and lives in some big tracial von Neumann algebra. For the most part of the talk, it will be tracial. I'll mention one instance where things are non-tracial. And then, well, what is S of T? S of T, this is free Brownian motion. So again, it means that you have S1 of sub T, Sn sub T. And this is a free Brownian motion, so that means that at each T, these are free semicircular operators, and they're free from the increments are free, so the increments are free from all the x of s is less than t. What is xi? Well, xi, you have to be able to make sense of xi of an n-tuple of non-commuting operators, which entails that you have to make some assumptions on xi. For instance, you might take xi to be a non-commutative polynomial. So xi will be either a non-commutative polynomial or maybe a non-commutative power series. And of course, you want situations that your variables fit into this multi-radius of convergence so that actually this power series is well-defined. And then, for some technical reason, I'm actually going to insert here a Q of xt. I'll explain. Well, actually, let me not insert it just yet. So let me just explain to you what it means to solve this equation like that. So what does it mean that x of t is a solution? Well, it just says that if you look at x of t plus epsilon minus x of t, then it behaves like an increment of free Brownian motion. So it's S of t minus S of t plus epsilon minus S of t minus 1/2 C of X of t times epsilon plus a term of order epsilon squared. Okay, so that's what it means. Yes?
Sorry, this is something that I never understand. Why don't you actually divide by epsilon?
Sure. But I just... There's a problem, which is that this is actually a priori of order epsilon 1 half in norm. But you could divide by epsilon 1 half and say something, and if you want to. But I would really like to think of it in this term for a reason that will become it will be a cue point for at some point later on in the course and talk. So, but the point is that this is the I was just teaching for 5 weeks a graduate student, so I mean I'm still in that. Anyway, so the thing is that right. So that's what it means to solve this equation. Now, as I said, for a technical reason, I'm going to try to put some coefficient here, q of xt sharp. So this requires some explanation. This q will be an n by n matrix over something. So this q will be a matrix whose entries are denoted qij. Now, what is in here will be, say, non-commuting polynomials in n variables squared. So it makes sense to evaluate such a matrix in an n tuple of variables. So it makes sense to talk about Q of X, T. It's going to be some matrix whose polynomials are tensors, each tensor component being some polynomial in the X's. And the sharp means, well, what this means, it's the sum over, so the ith component of this is going to be the sum over J, Q, ij, df, j, sharp, where this sharp means when I take A tensor B sharp, some S means A, S, B. So it's left-right multiplication. So you're replacing the tensor sign by this ds. Okay, yes? Okay, let's be safe and put 3 halves. You're right. Yeah. Well, I'm being rather imprecise about this. Let's put big O 3 halves. Anyways, it's higher than epsilon, which is the main point. Okay, so now the kind of the main theme here is given some non-commutative law, so it means that you're given some variables y1, yn, and their law means the traces of all polynomials in y1, yn. So it's prescribed to you what is the trace of a polynomial y1, yn. The motif is to try to realize this law as the law of a stationary solution to stochastic differential equation. So what does that mean? So we want a choice of Q and C such that there exists a solution X of T such that the law of this X of T is the law of your y's for all t. Okay, so we want a solution whose law does not evolve in time. Of course, the variables themselves do evolve in time, manifestly so, because they're bringing in more and more new free Brownian motion, but yet their law remains the same. And there's an immediate observation here, which... why would I ever want this? Well, there are two points here. One is that we'll see later on that this gives you a very nice approximation that is useful for something else. Okay? But the other point is that you might want to try to characterize certain laws as being the unique stationary solutions. So somehow, in certain instances, supplying this data, which is supplying Q and C, is equivalent to supplying the law. So what I was about to say is that actually this, what Alice calls Schwinger-Dyson equation, is in many instances equivalent to stating that there exists, or in certain instances it's equivalent to stating that your law is the unique stationary solution to a certain stochastic differential equation. Okay, so if you like, that is a third way of saying what is a, you know, you can say what's the law, you can say what the cumulants are, or you can say that there's this equation or the affiliated differential calculus to that equation. So that's what I wanted to say. So if you just differentiate the law of x of t at time t equals 0, you find more or less the following thing. So this is not exactly right, because you might run into a lot of trouble in the case that your things are not polynomials and so forth. But this being 0, in very big quotation marks, so for the purposes of this talk, even though it is not true, well, I mean, I don't know if it's true, if it's not true, but it's very technical, actually, each time to make the passage between them. It's more or less equivalent to the statement that if you take, if you look at the derivation from the algebra generated by your y's, so with mu of xt, x0 equals the mu of your y's, if you look at the derivation from the algebra generated by the y's, let's call this A, to some kind of a tensor square, you may have to pass to completion, as you'll see in a second, defined by saying that d of yj, sorry, to the power n, d of yj is the vector of these q's, q of y, I think 1j, q of y, nj. If you divide, define the specific derivation, then cj of y is equal to d star d of y. Okay, so and this is in the case that q is equal to this matrix here. Just take one tensor one down the diagonal. This equation is basically the Schwinger-Dyson equation. So, in the case that there's no q, and I'll explain to you why I ever want this q in this picture. In the case that there is no q, I mean the q is so simple. This is exactly this kind of Schwinger-Dyson equation that Alice. It's not a differential equation of any kind, indeed. It's just a certain equation which is saying that this element in L2 of y, so you're thinking of this thing as an unbounded operator on L2 of y, and of course you have the issues about domain and so forth, and you're just saying that is this. Yes? Yes. All the derivatives at zero vanishing. What would it? No. I'm not saying at all. But if you have a state, well, if you have a stationary solution for which all these, that's why I'm saying that this is in big quotation marks. You have to. I mean, so for instance, if somebody for some reason told you that your solution is analytic in T. Okay, then knowing this would allow you to conclude with a little bit of extra work that actually your solution is stationary. But in general, it is a certain amount of trouble to proving that this would entail that stationary. I mean, this is, of course, very close to stationarity. Okay. Just taking the first derivative is almost this equation, except that you have to restrict to the cyclic gradient space, whatever that is. So, anyways. But the thing I want to emphasize is that somehow this equation is morally the same as saying that you have some kind of a stationary solution. Morally, because of course you have all these analysis problems about being able to actually write down the appropriate equation. Well, in the case that your q is like this, then when you differentiate your y, you're just going to get one tensor one. When you take the adjoint, you're exactly going to ask the question of whether there are conjugate variables. In general, no. It is much weaker than saying that you have conjugate variables. Yeah, that's what I was saying. This is exactly the conjugate, right? So this is, in this case, this d star d are the conjugate variables. Yeah, exactly. But then this is an issue of whether you can write them as a polynomial or a power series or something else with which you can manipulate so that you can prove that actually you do have a stationary solution. That's a horrible problem. Okay, anyways. So the first point is that many laws can be characterized as the unique stationary solutions, or unique, maybe subject to some mild conditions. Of an SDE. So I just want to give some examples where that's the case. The most obvious example is where you take Q to be just a 1-by-1 matrix, 1 tensor 1, so n equals 1, and you take C to be a polynomial, to be in fact just H. So your equation just reads dx of t is equal to ds of t minus 1/2 x t. And if you work it out, you get, what, dt. Yes, I always forget dt, I don't know why. But anyways, if you work it out, then the unique solution is the semicircle. So this characterizes that, so the unique stationary solution is the semicircle. Now, if you don't want one semicircle law, maybe you want n semicircle laws. Not a big deal. Take an arbitrary n, take Q to be a matrix like that, and then if you write down the same thing, you get a semicircle family, free semicircle family. If you want some variances between them, of course, you just have to modify either this matrix or that matrix. And I think you just modify this matrix, and then you can make them having a variance. Okay. Let's say that you want something more interesting. Let's say that you're interested in having a matrix or semicircular. So you want Xij, and you want to know, you want Xij, say, free semicircular, and then the variance of Xij is from sigma ij, possibly sigma ij equals 0. So maybe you want a matrix which has some holes in it. Okay? Well, that's the place where you really want that Q to be 0. Then you basically take Q to be something like, I think it's just a matrix sigma ij, 1 tensor 1s. And then, you lose uniqueness. You may not, it's not the unique stationary solution. It's the unique stationary solution subject to these conditions. But then you get that the semicircles are a stationary solution. Okay, so I've done this as a hook for two reasons. One is that I just want to emphasize why you want an arbitrary Q, perhaps, because there are certain instances where you really want to think of this as a matrix with holes in it, one being the talk of von Jones. And I'll say a few words about that in a second. But the other reason was that in that thing, it's relevant to take derivations which have certain very specific values on the generator, so somehow that is the correct differential calculus that goes with it. That's what I'm trying to say. So maybe before proceeding to, well, let me just tell you the story. So in the process of proving that this trace that one defined, this trace zero on the graded algebra, the planar algebra, is non-negative. So one way to do it is to actually write down certain random matrices that implement that trace, whose law is given by this trace. And basically the situation is this, that you start with some graph, which is a bipartite graph with two sets of vertices, and then, let's say that you have some vertex here, some other vertex there, and you have some number of edges between these things. You create some matrix. So here I'll index that part by gamma 1, and that part will be indexed by gamma 2. And so if you mark off where the v-th coordinate is and the w-th coordinate is, you're going to take a little GUE matrix which is going to be, say, n by n, well, n by the suitable m. So that the ratio of n into m converges to something or other. The I think it's mu of the w of mu of v to the 1/2 of mu is the parent Frobenius eigenvector. And the GU is chosen so that the variance of entries is something like 1 over mu of v, mu of w to the power 1/2 times, the variance of. So what I mean to say is that if I take this, call this guy GE, GE star, and the trace of this, the normalized trace of this, converges to that. And what you arrange is that if you have multiple edges, then you create a new such independent matrix for each edge. And then you can check that actually when you start multiplying these matrices and forming words and so forth, you do get an honest model for this trace zero on the graded planar algebra of that bipartite graph. Okay, so that's one instance where you want to have a matrix with lots of zeros. In fact, you only have, you can think of this whole thing as being, you can put all these pieces together, so you can think of it as a huge matrix with lots and lots of zeros, only non-trivial entries where you have non-trivial numbers inside your adjacency matrix of your bipartite graph. Okay, so that's one instance where you want that. Anyways, that was sort of an aside. Another instance where you have, and I should have preceded this by saying that this is all joint work with Alice and Vaughan. So the other thing, the other instance where you have a characterization of a law by means of that kind of a stochastic differential equation is in the case that you have random matrix models. So I refer you to the talk of Alice Nionet. And in this case, so you're interested in the law where the trace of some polynomial in T1, Tn, or say Y1, Yn, is by definition the limit as n goes to infinity of a normalized integral like this. You take the normalized trace of P of, say, A1, An, and here you put e to the minus n trace of some ai squared, this is the Gaussian term, plus a perturbation, let's say some beta j q of qj a1, q is a bad letter because I already used it, r a1 an da1 dan. And so one of the things that Alice had done, and also is in our joint paper with her, is that one can prove that in the case that this potential is suitably convex, so that is the case, for instance, if these betas are sufficiently small, then there is a unique limit. So there's a unique limit which is a stationary, which is the unique stationary solution to the free SDE. And this free SDE is very simple. It's simply the one where dx t is equal to dst minus 1/2, and what you put here is the cyclic gradient of that of this expression. So some xj squared plus some beta j rj x1, xn. So the cyclic gradient, just to remind you, the cyclic gradient of some polynomial is the vector of cyclic derivatives. And the cyclic derivative of a monomial is the j, is the sum over ip equals to j. So over all ways that you can break up this polynomial into something with an xj in between and something else, let me write it, that may be an easier way of just saying that p equals to, say, a xj b, so I'm summing over all such things of b a. Okay, so you're differentiating out xj, but then you're putting b in front of a. And this equation here that I wrote down is exactly this Schwinger-Dyson equation that Alice had mentioned in her talk. Or it's, if you like, exactly the statement that the free conjugate variables are the cyclic derivatives of that polynomial. Now, just to give you a taste for how one gets to apply the fact that you have this free stochastic differential equation. So, in 2, you get a stronger statement which is that if you take any solution to this free stochastic differential equation that I have here, to this one, any solution which is simply sufficiently bounded converges in norm to a stationary solution. So what I mean is the following. I mean, imagine that you take this SDE okay, I think I forgot the, yeah, I did put the 1/2 in dp. Anyway, so if you write down one solution like this and you have another solution, say x prime, and by using some Picard argument, what you find is that the norm of x of t minus x prime of t actually converges to zero as t goes to infinity. So the two solutions in norm have to be uniformly getting closer and closer. So the game you play is that you just start, you insist that x zero is your y, so the ones that you're trying to model, having the which has stationary law. But then you insist that x zero prime, for instance, is zero. And then what happens is that because x zero prime is zero, if you think about what this equation means. When you're starting from zero, what you will be building up is some very complicated function of purely free Brownian motion. So this will be in the C-star algebra generated by all of these S less or equal than T. So C-star algebra, which is generated by some free semicircular family. And so that allows you to get a wealth of information about the C-star algebra that these guys generate, and that C-star algebra is always the same, because the C-star algebra generated by your x1 of t, xn of t, is of course isomorphic to the C-star algebra generated by your y1, yn, the ones that have the stationary law, simply because they have the same law, so they generate the same C-star algebra. So that's, for instance, how you prove that the stationary solution, this C-star algebra has no projections. If it were to have a projection, you could approximate that projection by a polynomial in the y's, and you would get some self-adjoint element that has a spectral gap. And then if you look at the same polynomial here, you would see that you'll end up producing a polynomial in this C-star algebra that has a spectral gap. So you'll end up with a projection in this C-star algebra, and then Pinsner and Voiculescu showed, I don't know, 25 years ago, something like that, that this is not possible. So you know, that's an application. And you get lots of information. I mean, so from this you get that the C-star of y1, yn is projectionless. You get that the von Neumann algebra has the Haar group property.
You get lots of trades.
No, I get, I'm talking always, so the y's always have the fixed trace, which is that stationary law. Right, these are fixed. Right. I don't know. It's a very, very good question. I don't know. I mean, they form some kind of a natural deformation of free group factors, but what we end up proving is that you see the Sicht algebras and the von Lehmann algebras have a lot of properties in common with the thing. The other thing you get here is that it's exact. And the other thing you get by a similar technique, at least if your potential is really strictly convex, if your potential is convex, I mean, not for these potentials, unfortunately, but if you have a potential that's convex regardless of any norm conditions on the H, you get a result, I mean, using actually Uffe's result, Uffe and Steen's result on the semicircular systems, one can prove that actually this random matrix model is norm convergent. Again, by using this story that there's some nice approximation. So that's one instance for it. Well, if you have a convex potential. If you don't have a convex potential, that need not happen, right? As far as I understand the classical case. And here, by the way, it certainly does not have to happen if you have a non-convex potential, even in the one variable case. You could have things where you get trapped in. Oh, no, one thing which fails in the classical case, I'm sorry, is the fact that you have norm convergence. So in the classical case, you will have convergence in LP for every p less than infinity because your increment is not bounded. But here, because the increment is bounded, because this ds is a semicircular Brownian motion, you get actually the Burkholder-Gundy inequality actually holds in L infinity, as was observed already by Philippe and Roland. Okay, let me turn to number three, which, so I have, what, 15 minutes or? So let me turn to topic number three, which is, actually I have to admit to you that I'm pretty sure that this works, but I did not check that my estimate for Q is completely correct, so what I'll write at the moment, 0.26, it might be 0.12, I don't know what I mean at this. So a law that you can realize as a stationary law is that of a Q semicircular family. So I don't think I have time to describe what it is, but there's we have these Q-deformed free group factors, which were introduced by Bojeko and Speicher. What am I saying, Paul? Piotr should help me out. Bojeko and Speicher. Something is wrong, right?
Not over that.
Ah, yes, of course. So what are these free group factors? Well, just in short, there are these creation operators. You know, the usual one satisfy this law that this is delta ij. And these satisfy something like this minus q, them in the opposite order, l, j, l, I star. And then you again take the real parts and so on. So the claim is that if Q is for Q positive and sufficiently small, then some F of N, where F of N behaves like, I believe, like 1 over N squared, and F of 2 is less than 0.26, you can realize this in a free SDE with Q and C power series. I don't think you can do it with polynomials, but with power series such that your Q semicircular family is a stationary solution. It's actually the law. I should say that the law of this Q semicircular family is a stationary solution. Well, sounds like a sort of a completely silly statement, but let me immediately tell you the corollary of this. In this range of delta, in this range of Q, the free entropy dimension of this Q semicircular family is strictly bigger than 1. And I'll explain to you very briefly how to get this result. And this has an implication that the actual factor, the Q factor, for instance, has no Cartan. And many other properties that can be derived. So this, of course, is a result of Voiculescu, that once the free entropy dimension is bigger than one, then you have very have certain non-decomposability properties. Primeness was proved by Leninger, and various other things. And in some things were already known. I think primeness, I may have proved. I think so. Property gamma, I think Piotr Snyadi proved that it's non-gamma. It's Snyadi proved. But anyways, you get lots of thinness, and it cannot be written as the span of some number of free group factors once this is big. I actually have a better estimate than one in this case. So let me sketch for you very, very quickly, and I'm afraid that I'm going to completely put you to sleep now, because it's going to be a bit technical, but I hope to make it very entertaining. So actually, the way I got into this subject of stochastic differential equations is by trying to solve the following problem. So you have these L2 Betti numbers, say for a group. The L2 Betti numbers for a group, so gamma is a discrete group. And then you play it off versus the free entropy dimension of the group generators. So one consequence of lots of work, including Bian Capitan Guionet's paper on inequality between various entropies and so on and so forth, my paper with Kwan, my paper with Miniev, is that you have an inequality like that, that this free entropy dimension, whatever it is bounded by this stuff with L2 Betti numbers. And so the issue is, when do you have an opposite inequality? There's an obvious obstruction to that called the Kwan embedding question. But I was at least trying to understand intrinsically why there could be a relation between these two quantities. So what is this? This is the dimension of the space of certain derivations from the group algebra into actually L2 of the group tensor itself. So it's actually simply the dimension of the space of all of these derivations. But the dimension is taken over the group algebra. It's the Murray von Neumann dimension taken over the group algebra, because this, if you act here on the right on both copies, it's obviously a bimodule. So before I get into this, right, so what is this? Well, this is some kind of a Hausdorff dimension. Also kind of a relative and a renormalized Hausdorff dimension of some diffuse quantity of some object which Voiculescu calls microstate space. So, the inequality one way you have, so let's not worry about this. What does the inequality this way say? Well, you somehow want to claim it's analogous to the statement that the dimension of the linear dimension of the tangent space to a manifold is less or equal than the Hausdorff dimension of that manifold. How do you prove that? Well, I'll tell you in a second, but intuitively you do it by the exponential map. You have to somehow produce lots of balls, and to do that you use the exponential map. So intuitively you want to understand how to exponentiate objects from here to produce stuff there. So what I claim is that this exponential map is the stochastic differential equation. More precisely, let me state the theorem that I could prove. So if y1, yn, generate some von Neumann algebra, which is R omega embeddable, which just says that these microstate spaces are not empty. Then the dimension over M tensor M opposite of the space of closable derivations from the algebra generated by Y1, Yn. Unfortunately, all I can do is into the algebra squared, And even worse, I need to assume that D takes this algebra back into itself. Okay, probe J. With this dimension, it gives you a lower estimate in delta naught. Of y1, yn. So if you specialize for the group, it tells you that the dimension over the group algebra, over the space of all cocycles from the group into the group algebra, what I would really like to have here is L2 of the group, is less or equal than delta naught of any generators of gamma. And the upper estimate, by the way, is exactly what you want. It's the dimension over L of gamma of all cocycles from gamma into L2 of gamma. So you want to take the closure here, of course. So you're almost there, except that there's this little technical problem. Where's the technical problem? Well, the technical problem is simply in the existence of the stationary solution to this stochastic differential equation, because you recognize, well, this term actually turns out to be fairly fine for a group. It's actually a polynomial. But you recognize that the Q, I don't know if I still have it there, but this Q is the range of this derivation on the y's. So if this Q is an L2, I don't know what to do. I mean, I don't know what does it mean to evaluate an L2 function in y1, yn. So let me explain to you why am I saying that this free stochastic differential equation is a way to exponentiate stuff. So let's look again at this free stochastic differential equation. X of t plus epsilon is equal to x of t plus, well, let me write it like this. S of from time t to time t plus epsilon will be gone in a second. Plus, well, minus, I guess, 1/2 C of X of T times epsilon plus something O of epsilon. You're absolutely right. It should be 3/2. Okay? Now, so in general, I will have a Q here. Okay, but let me imagine that there's no Q. Okay, just for simplicity's sake. Let me imagine that there's no Q. And having no Q means that I'm going to start to prove that in that case, this bimodule is actually everything because you have all the tensors 1 and all positions in it. So I'll try to prove that the free entropy dimension is at least n. So aim is that the free entropy dimension is at least n being the number of variables that you have at your disposal. So let's understand what this is saying. Well, this is saying that if I have my x of t plus epsilon, well, that this is equal to x of t plus the semicircular perturbation of order root epsilon. This is my S. Okay. Plus a correction which is of order epsilon. Because all this thing is a correction. It's certainly of order epsilon. Now, what's this saying? Well, imagine that you have some guy here, little x, which approximates very well in law, so it's going to be some n-tuple of matrices, which approximates very well in law your x, your y1, yn. All right, and the other thing I want to say is that the law of x of t plus epsilon is the same as the law of x of t, which is the law of your original y1, yn. Okay? So imagine you have actually little y whose law is approximately the law of the capital Ys. Okay? Now, I'm going to look at y plus square root of ts, which is some semicircular perturbation. Now, a semicircular that's free from y is just about any direction in my manifold. I mean, it's just about any matrix I have. Any matrix I have is going to be almost surely semicircular and free from y. So basically, I take any direction I want, okay? And the question is, where does this land? Well, so this line here is all y such that the law of y is approximately the law of capital Y. Among all these little y's, I'm going to have this x of t plus epsilon. This x of t plus epsilon can be manufactured once I know xt and my semicircular Brownian motion by this differential equation. So somewhere here I'll be able to manufacture a y prime, which will be this xt plus epsilon. With what property? Well, the property that this guy here is of order t to the manifold, right? So I have this y prime, the distance to that guy is like that. So what's this saying? It's saying that if you start in the manifold and you move off in a completely arbitrary direction for time root t, your distance from the manifold is growing by t. And what does that mean? It means that your line was tangent. So it means that every line is tangent. That means that the dimension is maximum. You have to do a little bit of an argument with covering numbers, which is actually fairly straightforward. You're saying that if you take a covering number here of size t, then this covering number actually has to also cover more or less that set of perturbed things, and from that you actually get the estimate and free entropy dimension. Right, so where did the causal derivations come in? Well, you see, I needed to begin with to know that I have a stationary solution to my differential equation, which I don't. I don't know. I mean, in particular, just to write down this C, to remind you, this was my d star d of x, I needed to know it existed. So, it actually, you know, fundamentally pinpoints where the problem is. The problem is, you know, from the point of view of this technology, is not really in the estimates on microstates, which was traditionally the hard part. That's done. I mean, once you have this estimate like that, that's straightforward. The difficulty is in proving that you have actually a solution to this free stochastic differential equation. So I want to make two comments before I quit. What we've actually proved, under assumptions that you are a stationary solution of an SDE, is the following thing. So this is sort of a remark for experts. The Wasserstein distance between the law of x and the law of the semicircular perturbation of x is O of t. Okay, because we've explicitly realized somebody else that has the same law as your given x as a little perturbation of the semicircular thing. So this kind of inequality occurred in classical probability. I don't know where, and then certainly learned of it in the paper of Otto and Delany on the Talleyrand inequality. And I don't know if it probably doesn't originate from there. I don't know. Anyways, that's certainly the place where I've learned of it. The free case of it, in the n equals 1 case, one has a much better statement that this guy is less or equal than, I forget the constant, I think it's 1/2 times coefficient formation of x, of the law of x, to the power 1/2 times t. And that is exactly like you have in the classical case. And this is a result of Bianco-Vulescu. And that's actually from their paper on transportation cost inequality. That is really the main step in the proof of the transportation cost inequality. And that was actually exactly what Otto and Delany were proving. So what we're doing is we're doing a baby version of that in the case that our variables are very nice. So we can prove this inequality in the case that the law of x, for instance, is the law of this random matrix model with polynomial potentials. So, you know, it's not a very, very big step, but anyways. The other comment I want to make is that although this theorem sounds very algebraic and very silly, you could say, well, maybe there aren't any derivations like that. Since I want you to be mad at me for something, I'm going to make the statement that actually this theorem contains essentially all known estimates on free entropy dimension except for one. Okay? So let me just give you some applications of this theorem. So corollaries. Well, of course you get that the free entropy dimension of a semicircular family is equal to n because the semicircular family has derivations like this. That's going back to Voiculescu's. Inner derivations are contained in that space, and let's call this V. Are contained in that space V, And if you work out what is the space of this inner derivations, you recover something that Kenley Jung calls hyperfinite monotonicity. You get that if M is embeddable into R omega and M diffuse, then delta naught of your Y1 Yn is bigger or equal than 1, because you can work out that the dimension of this thing is at least 1. Okay. If you take gamma group, so in the following class, so take a class containing, and get this right, all groups with first Betting number 0, which is closed under free products, under amalgamation over finite groups, finite extensions, and finite index, and passage to finite index subgroups. So if you have a group there, you can replace it by a finite index subgroup, or you pass to a finite index extension, then gamma is R omega embeddable, then delta naught of gamma is actually the appropriate combination of delta Betting numbers. So a result a bit like this, I think they allowed more amalgamation, is due to Ken Dykema and I think Nate Brown and Kenley Jung a year ago. And so, I mean, there was quite a bit of sweat, if I remember correctly, to do this. But this just comes out of the wash from analysis of what kind of co-cycles you can get on these groups. You know, all these co-cycles end up being algebraic, so you're there. So one result, by the way, which you cannot get with this method, and that's really the big obstruction in some stuff having to do with delta Betting numbers, is that the free entropy dimension of x1, xn, comma y1, ym is bigger or equal than delta naught of x1, xn if the yj's are in the Fenomen algebra generated by the x's. This is a result of Riculescu. And I don't know how to get this with that estimate. But somehow a lot of results, you see, can be obtained from that. Somehow, you see, a lot of the techniques that we've had so far in free probability theory for dealing with Fenomen algebras are algebraic, which are reflected in the fact that here, when we're dealing with these derivations and co-cycles, we end up dealing with things which are algebraic. If you do things like free products, a little bit of amalgamation, etc., etc., all your derivations continue to be algebraic. What is very nice, though, is that this technique, as evidenced by this story with the q-semicircular variable, starts working also in absence of such algebraic assumptions. I mean, you'd still need some analyticity and so forth, but you're going a little bit beyond that kind of cut-and-paste manipulations that were at the beginnings of free probability. So that's basically what I wanted to say. I don't know. There's a very nice question, which I have no idea if anybody has thought about, which is, for instance, whether every group which has a proper L2 cocycle is isomorphic to a free group. And it's a bit like asking if every subgroup of a subfact, non-hyperfinite subfact of a free group factor is a free group factor. I don't know. It's not isomorphic, measure equivalent to a free group. It's I don't know.
So you pick a law of polynomials. If your data,
Yeah, I mean, you can translate what happens with these derivations. You know, you have the original derivations that start with, that, you know, that work with the generators. If you replace your generators by some polynomials in them, then of course these old derivations now remain derivations, and these new derivations will have a different value of q, which are simply the values of that old derivations in your polynomials. If this translation is invertible, this q will become an invertible matrix. And then the dimension of the space will become the same, because what were the Voiculescu difference quotient derivations for the generators will now become these same derivations evaluated on these new generators, which now have as value some q. But that q being invertible, the dimension of this bimodule will be the same as the dimension for the original one. So that's why I'm saying that somehow polynomial functional calculus is what does not touch this thing.